Like drinking, suicide is one of our big problems. We'll talk about that now, and it's not confined to New Zealand. Suicide rates among young people have continued to soar in the United States, the Harvard Medical School reported this past week, especially among 15 to 19-year-olds and young men. The number of children going to ER, A&E, with suicidal thoughts or attempts has doubled since the year 2000, and the overall suicide rate there has gone up by 35%. And we mentioned recently the significant rise in such deaths among the white population in the US, and middle-aged men as well. The supposition is worsening life prospects among less educated people, but there's no proof. What other US researchers have found, as reported in the Washington Post, is that when the minimum wage increased or when states boosted a tax credit for working families, the suicide rate went down. That correlation's from their National Bureau of Economic Research, which projected that a great many lives could be saved simply by a modest improvement in the finances of vulnerable people. Dr. Tony Dowell is Professor of Primary Healthcare at the University of Otago, Wellington. Good morning, Tony.
Kia ora, good morning, Jim.
Kia ora. We know the link between suicide and disadvantaged circumstances. So how simple might the solutions be here for improving the suicide and mental health situations in New Zealand?
I think the short answer is that the solutions are very unlikely to be simple, both here in New Zealand and even in the US, where the study that you were talking about came from. But there's lots of opportunities to improve the current very challenging suicide and mental health scenarios. And the US work has certainly got some important take-home messages. Now, I guess the Washington Post article and the original paper from which that article was taken extends the known links between poverty and poor mental health outcomes to modelling and estimating the impact on suicide of increasing minimum wage or adjusting tax credits. Now, there's a number of caveats to that work, I think. The American social welfare and healthcare systems are very different, for example, but some of the principles are certainly in line with other work linking poverty to mental health problems. And that research certainly did show that in those settings, increasing the amount of money that people had reduced the suicide rate. There's at least one New Zealand study which specifically looked at the effect of being unemployed on suicide, and that showed that there was a 2 to 3-fold increased relative risk of death by suicide compared to if you were employed. But we also know that there are many factors involved in suicidal thoughts and attempts, and sadly in those cases where suicide occurs. And those include psychological, social, historical, cultural factors, as well as the very important economic factors such as poverty.
Māori men and young Māori men suffer out of all proportion to their percentage of the population, and we make the usual assumptions in general terms about social estrangement and the lack of a path, life path and prospects and so on. But again, restating our original point, could the remedy be less complex than the causes?
I think yes, for both suicidality and mental health problems in general, there are specific causes of very significant concern for Māori, and particularly for Māori men. Remedies in life for difficult stuff, I think, are rarely less complex than causes. But I think there are some important specific issues in terms of mental health and suicidality for tangata whenua and tangata whaiora. So you're right that the suffering for Māori is out of all proportion to the population percentage. So the suicide rate amongst Māori men across all age groups is about 1.4 times that of non-Māori, and it's much higher for Māori youth, about 3 times higher than for non-Māori. We know that mental health problems occur in Māori at rates that are as high or even higher than the total population. But we also know that contact with health services for Māori with mental health problems, for example, is lower than for non-Māori. And very importantly for the topic of this conversation, Māori bear a very disproportionate burden of socioeconomic disadvantage. So socioeconomic status, poverty are important contributing factors to mental health problems among Māori and to suicidality. But it's not the only contributing factor. And after adjusting for socioeconomic status, the amount of mental health problems is still a lot higher in Māori populations. And it's here that I think discrimination and clearly the rates of mental health problems and suicidality that are seen amongst all Indigenous populations is an important factor. So that we know that there are a significant amount of discrimination and stigma for Indigenous populations and, in fact, for people with mental health problems. We also know that in this area, discrimination has got a serious negative impact on Māori mental health. For example, there was a school study, a study of Māori high school students, which showed that experiencing discrimination actually halved their well-being scores. It doubled their depressive symptoms, and it was associated with over twice the rate of suicidality. And in the same study, when students were expressed a strong Māori cultural identity, then that was improved with very significantly improved well-being scores and much fewer depressive symptoms.
At the University of California, Berkeley, two economists analysed what they termed deaths of despair among low-wage workers from official stats, and the suicide rate fell very quickly as a result of state government financial assistance. And the biggest effect was in African-American communities, which does invoke a comparison with Māori here, doesn't it?
Only to some extent, I think, but it was important there to recognise that there were other factors which were important. So the long-term impact of colonisation, the effects of stigma and discrimination would be potentially important factors here which didn't necessarily apply in the US setting. But it's clearly true that reducing poverty and increasing wealth amongst those who are poorest, that is likely to have a significant impact on suicidality. And we also shouldn't underestimate the impact that educational achievements got on self-esteem and feelings of self-worth. I guess one of the things which seems to come out of the Princeton work, though, thinking about educational achievement, is that we could debate how much the pressure to achieve educationally may have negative consequences, looking at mental health and suicide rates. So, for example, countries where the pressure to achieve educationally is very high, South Korea, for example, comes to mind, has the third highest suicide rate. So I think there needs to be a balance in the discussion around educational achievement.
Yeah, and that in itself is complex, educational achievement, as you've just been saying. But it does lead to purpose. And I know factors are complex, and you've outlined some of them very well. But there's also the old psychiatric adage that, you know, you can fix things from the outside in as well as from the inside out. Or at least you can apply, in this case, a partial remedy in terms of improving people's material circumstances. I guess that's what I'm getting at, and whether, in fact, that would be an important adjunct to whatever else we're going to do, which is going to take a long time to do. So there is some truth, though, that if you're better off materially, you're going to have more of the stuff you need to improve your mental health, even if there are a lot of factors at play and some of them are historical and very difficult to kind of get improvements in.
Yes, absolutely. And I wouldn't in any way want to underestimate the impact of poverty of all sorts on mental health, well-being and resilience. And we wouldn't be just talking about economic poverty, important though that is. Educational poverty, poverty in relationships, social poverty, you know, social isolation, all of those different sorts of poverty are important.
Your interest is in primary care mental health research, and you know about the patterns and drivers of mental distress. Mental health problems are more common for women, Tony, but men have the more trouble asking for help?
Yes, that is the case. So the overall amount of mental health problems is higher in women, but there's a lot of research and literature indicating that often it's men who find it more difficult to ask for help. And mental health problems are certainly very common in men. About 12% of New Zealand men will have depression, 20% of men will experience anxiety at any point in time. And one key element seems to be communication. It's too simplistic to say that women are willing to share the problems and men tend to bottle them up. But I guess for many generations, many societies have encouraged men to be strong and not admit that they're struggling. So I think, and linked to suicidality, there is a crisis in men's mental health. The suicide rate for men is four times that of women. And underneath this, I think there is a real need for us to question masculinity and what it means to be a man. There's actually a thing called the conforming to masculine norm scale, which looks at seven different factors of masculinity. Things like self-reliance, so blokes need to do everything on their own, asking for help is a weakness, may partly explain why men are less likely to seek help. And we know that if we don't reach out, then depression can worsen. If we don't reach out, we're less likely to have support networks. Another factor is needing to be strong, to be in control of your emotions. Compassion may not be seen as manly. For men, anger is the most common emotion. And men indulge in more risky behavior than women. And there are male ideas about success. So although the notion of man as a family breadwinner is in decline, men still feel expected to be a winner and of high status. So as we've been talking about, I think there may be particular problems with kind of young people and vulnerability, particularly for men in terms of growing up. So those pressures to become a man, to prove your worth, find your place in the tribe and so on. If we link that to the poverty discussion, then firstly, I guess we should start by reminding that in general, women are poorer than men in most societies and most settings. So gender discrimination, gender pay gaps are still a major issue. So we know that in some ways, women have greater intrinsic resilience than men. When men and women are subjected to harsh conditions, it's women who live longer. So from a poverty perspective, how does that play out? There's actually research which shows men and women tend to react differently to poverty in terms of their resilience and their mental health. So a study which showed that a third nearly of men felt that their partner would see them as less of a person if they lost their job or they didn't have one, compared to only just over 10% of women. 40% of men felt the need to be the main breadwinner in a household, compared to less than 30% of women. And men are more likely to do the work that they do because of pay and economic security compared to women. And also, men are much more likely to report a range of consequences following job loss.
We're talking more about revised maleness, and sports stars are discussing vulnerability of their own. But at the same time, there is a less relaxed and more driven, tougher society, people intuit, in terms of the workplace. So there are factors mitigating against getting progress in this area too. Would that be fair?
I think so. And also, increasingly, I guess all generations feel this, but the world is becoming increasingly pressurized, increasingly faster paced. There is a huge amount of uncertainty, economic uncertainty, global uncertainty, uncertainty about the planet and so on. All of those things, I think, are contributing to a feeling of unsettlement.
I want to ask you one thing. We're shining a light into mental illness, and obviously we're making progress because we're all more aware of it. Do we need to stop talking about suicide, though? Suicide spiked in the months after Netflix released 13 Reasons Why, apparently. Is there a better approach that shines a light into mental health but minimises discussion about self-harm?
No, I don't think we should stop talking. After 13 Reasons Why was shown, it did appear that there was an increase in suicide rates amongst US children. But there was a lot of discussion and debate about those figures. And in fact, further research showed that it was more complex than was thought, so that people who stopped watching partway through the season exhibited higher suicide risk, were less optimistic than those who watched the final episode. And also people who finished watching the series reported lower levels of suicidal ideation and self-harm than people who didn't watch the show. And that may be because towards the end it apparently portrayed the protagonist's friend being able to cope with challenges. Now, for everybody who dies by suicide, there's nearly another 300 people who would think seriously about it but actually don't carry through to a completed act. So, in fact, in many ways, the media portrayals, and particularly 13 Reasons Why, don't show the true reality of that ratio. If we show people coping, and that's associated with a reduction in suicide rates, then it means that we shouldn't really be fearful of having conversations. What there needs to be is a realistic portrayal of the way that people feel about themselves and about their lives. There's still many examples, I think, of the media being irresponsible. So overseas studies, for example, showing that over 80% of stories about mental health in general are still negative. I've got to say, I think the New Zealand media are much, much better than that, and well done.
Complex problems and no immediate solutions in society, and I imagine that was always the case. But we're talking about how tough it can be out there. If you haven't watched 13 Reasons Why right through, which was an interesting revelation from you, if you are feeling desperate, what is the best thing to do? Because the helplines always come up on the TV, but people probably don't even only half notice them these days. They're so common. What is your best advice?
I think we need to make clear the corrosive impact of social factors such as poverty on mental health. Collectively, we need to work to decrease stigma about mental illness so that we can seek help easily. The research that started your listeners' question about this topic wasn't wrong. So poverty is an important issue when it comes to mental health problems and to suicidality. That's particularly significant, I think, when it comes to child poverty. So to that extent, policies around the living wage, policies to reduce the impact of child poverty will have an important impact on mental health in general and on suicidality. Employment and income generating opportunities must be created for people with mental and psychosocial problems, because we know that it's much more difficult if you're in poverty to get a job. Having that focus on the early years is really important. So it's been argued that by intervening early and effectively, up to kind of 50% of the current burden associated with mental disorders might be averted. The 1737 phone line text free call is there all the time. There is a lot of commitment to this area, and that the government's commitment and the money in the recent budget is something really to be welcomed in order to improve the current situation.
Professor Tony Dale, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim.